Nein, 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 nein. Shalom, shalom, wonderful friends. I hope you will be singing Manishkana this year, or that some child or grandchild will be singing it at your table. We are a people of questions. We are not a people of answers, although we have many great answers, but a people of questions. And that's one of our great contributions to the world. Actually, one of the things we'll come to later in this series is the power of questions and of reinterpretation. This is one of our great gifts and contributions to the world that we get from the Talmud, is the Talmud is full of questions, and we will come to that. But today we have a fascinating topic, that we were slaves in Egypt, something that is so obvious to us and yet has been such a remarkable contribution to the world that we will explore today. But before we do that, let's hear your thoughts on this poll question. On universalism, option one, social justice, so however you want to fill in that phrase, tikkun olam, repairing the world, is a small part of Judaism, really just a recent new innovation by progressive Jews. Option one. Option two, social justice, tikkun olam, is central to Judaism from the start until now. Option three, social justice is certainly a part of Judaism, but just one part among countless others. Would love to hear your thoughts on those three. Of course, as always, there are many other choices in the world, but those are our three choices today. Social justice is a small part of Judaism. It is central, or it is certainly a part among many others. Wow, very interesting. Okay, so nobody here suggested that social justice is a small part of Judaism, really just a recent new innovation by progressive Jews, as some people suggest. 40% says social justice is central to Judaism from the start until now. And 60% here believe social justice is certainly a part of Judaism, but just one part among countless others. Okay, terrific. So friends, let's dive in. As usual, unless you're new, I'll let you know. I'm going to present for about 20-ish minutes. Feel free to write in the chat if you want to communicate to each other while I'm doing that. And then I'm going to open up the conversation about this topic. The story, and by the way, this is perfect timing with Pesach being just a week and a half away to get our heads in the into this topic here. The story of our oppression under Pharaoh and miraculous liberation from Egypt is at the center of our Jewish identity. Every year at the Passover Seder, we tell the Exodus story of how we were brought up out of Egypt. The very word for the Passover ritual text, Haggadah, means telling. We dip our herbs in salt water to remember the sweat and tears of affliction. We stomach our bitterness. We recite the plagues that God sent to free us. And of course, we eat only unleavened bread for the duration of the holiday, commemorating the haste of our fleeing. This is the story that we tell ourselves as a people to understand who we are at our essence. We are free, but once we were slaves. The story of our slavery in Egypt lives in the Torah well beyond the book of Exodus. Over and over, as the commandments are given on how we should conduct ourselves as a people, those commandments are fortified with the harsh reminder that we, the Jews, were oppressed in the land of Mitzrayim, Eretz Mitzrayim, the land of Egypt. These injunctions are consistent features of the books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Remember, you were slaves in Egypt. It says, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. That's Deuteronomy and Exodus, respectively. To remember this slavery as a tenet of Judaism, the myriad of implications of that tenet is why we were slaves in Egypt, is one of the great Jewish ideas. The most obvious implication of the remembering that we were slaves in Egypt is that of empathy that it will engender. What we might call the ethos of Mitzrayim brings us to the spiritual awareness of otherness. Through our experience of bondage in Egypt, being enslaved by Paro, fleeing for our lives into the desert, we are aligned with the most vulnerable. This central narrative of our tradition requires us to hold on to a mindfulness of alienation, marginalization, and oppression. We are always striving to live with empathy for others because of how central our historical oppression is in our own spiritual consciousness. In fact, central to the liturgy, to the prayer experience, is this consistent reminder, you were slaves, you were slaves. In situations where we have the power of being an insider, be that as individuals who attain class privilege or as a Jewish people who have attained political autonomy, our tradition teaches us that we must never lose the memory of being an outsider. By remembering the suffering that we as a people have historically faced, we reinforce our compassion for those suffering among us today. The Torah indicates several vulnerable identities that B'nai Yisrael, because we were slaves in Egypt, must treat with kindness and dignity, including widows, orphans, the needy, and the enslaved, in particular, the ger, the yatom, and the almanah. The word ger is one that has evolved over time in its usage. In the Torah, a ger is a sojourner, an outsider, stranger in a strange land. In Genesis, the concept is used in reference to our patriarchs in the land of Canaan. Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are all described as having sojourned, gar, in the land throughout Genesis 35:27, throughout Exodus 6:4. Later in Torah, as the liberated people of Israel make their way to the promised land of Eretz Yisrael, the definition of ger shifts again. We are the insiders, and the ger is the outsider. Once we are a people, the commandments regarding the treatment of the gerim refer to non-Jews in our midst, Gentiles who are a minority in a Jewish space, the outsiders among us. By the time we get to the Talmud, however, the word ger refers to a convert. Very different meaning. And once again, a Gentile who is a minority in a Jewish space, but here one that has a religious connotation, one that is joining the community as a member rather than as a protected minority outside membership. The instances of the Torah, of God commanding us to care for the gerim, meaning to care for the non-Jew living in Jewish spaces, are countless, although people try to count. It says over here in Exodus 22:20, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. It says over here in Exodus 23:9, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the soul of the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Interesting, you know their soul. There's a spiritual connotation. It says over here in Leviticus 19:34, the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as one of your citizens. You shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Don't just protect his rights or her rights. Love them, right? Emotionally. It says over here in Deuteronomy 10:19, you too must befriend the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Don't just spiritually connect. Don't just defend their rights. Don't just love them. Make them a friend. It says over here in Deuteronomy 23:8, you shall not hate any Egyptian, for you were a stranger in his land. So interesting enough that you take your oppressor, the worst oppressor you could imagine, 400 years where you had no property rights, you had no human rights, you were whipped and beaten and worked to the bone, you were oppressed to the worst imaginable in human history, but do not hate them. Remove your hate from the heart, even for them, right? Because that oppression is over. Now, maybe if you're still in the midst of the oppression, you're still being whipped. I don't think you can say, don't hate the person whipping you, right? Although Nelson Mandela was one of the rare humans who was capable of that, right? Loving the prison guard who was still torturing him, even though the torture got less and less over time. It's still nonetheless, at least psychologically. Nelson Mandela. But over here, I don't think we can expect humans to not hate the one who is physically oppressing them in that moment. But once you're out, once you're liberated, it's a different reality. So those are just five verses of so many others. The rabbinic sources actually tell us that these formulations regarding the treatment of gerim appears 36 times in the Torah. Now, 36 is, of course, a special Jewish number because it's double chai. 18 is life, chai, because chet is the eighth letter and yud is the 10th letter. And so 10 plus 8 is 18. And so that's why chai, 18 is life. And 36, so Jews typically donate in multiples of 18, oftentimes, as a sign of spreading life. And so 36 times in the Torah represents that part of centrality of the life experience is finding the most vulnerable in life experience and making them the center of the world. However, Rabbi Eliezer the Great says over there in Bava Metzia in the Talmud that the ger is mentioned in the Chumash not 36 times, but 48 times. 48 times. 46 times. 46 times. So very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, the parallels are very clear. Once we were gerim, now we are obligated to care for the gerim who live in our lands. Now we are free, but once we fled Egypt, bringing only what we could carry, what might we imagine of that experience? Mothers hushing their children, lest they make no noise and draw attention to themselves. Food hurriedly wrapped in cloth. No time to let the bread rise. No time at all, because at any moment, Pharaoh may change his mind. Anxious whispers. Are we really doing this? Can we really make it? Will we survive in the wilderness? We are leaving the only life we have ever known. Everyone leaving Egypt was born in Egypt, born into bondage, born with the mentality that they were less than their overlords. This was all we knew. Although we were terrified, we left in hopes of a promised land. Something better, maybe not for us, but maybe for our children. Today, the ger is the foreigner we care for in the workplace and in our communities. Because we have the experience of gerim in our Jewish DNA, we are prepared, in fact commanded, to extend this consciousness towards immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and others. We can imagine a young mother fleeing not Egypt, say, but say Honduras, cracking north through Central America towards Mexico, where she will attempt to cross into the United States. She travels with her baby on her back. She has left the town she lived in all her life, the neighbors she knows and who know her, the food she is familiar with, the customs she grew up with, the language that is familiar to her. The farther north she gets, the more exhausted her body gets. The Spanish sounds strange up here in a new dialect. She misses her home, but she can't go back. She's fleeing gang violence. She knows that many do not make the crossing into America. They don't survive it physically, psychologically, legally. She's heard that the wall extends far into the desert, that the American guards chase down migrants and separate families. She knows she might not make it, but she will try in order that the baby on her back might have a chance at a good life. We can imagine the Syrian family fleeing the war that their children were born into. Over 13 years of civil war, not to mention recent earthquakes, have destroyed their neighborhoods in Syria. The parents remember as beautiful, vibrant communities. Nothing is left but rubble. Their children have known their country only in war. They have not gone to school or played outside. The risk of snipers and missiles made it too dangerous. The children can recognize weapons by the sounds they make. This is not the life that parents want for their children. They make the difficult decision to tear up their centuries-old roots in Syria and flee to Germany. They walk at night to avoid detection. They walk for days. The children are tired. They are walking towards a boat that will take them to Germany. Many have perished in this crossing, but it's their only hope. Our ability to empathize with these experiences makes us more motivated to welcome the strangers in our communities and treat them with care and dignity. Indeed, creating empathy is an important element of the Passover Seder. When we remember our flight from Egypt, the bitterness, the salty tears, when we enter the Seder space, we must emotionally return to Mitzrayim for it to be an authentic experience. We are told in every generation, a person must see himself or herself as though he or she has gone out of Egypt themselves. During the Seder, we are there. We are in Egypt. We feel it fully. It's such a radical ritual. However, we can't stay there. It's not tenable to remain in a place of deep despair and disenfranchisement. If we want to bring other people out of Mitzrayim, whether their Mitzrayim is a violence-ravaged country, or whether it's the mass incarceration in our own country, we ourselves must leave Mitzrayim. In embodying our liberation, we are able to be allies for those surviving the Ger experience today. It's cyclical. Every year we enter Mitzrayim and remember bondage, and every year we are liberated. We're not solely rooted in otherness, nor are we solely rooted in our personal narratives. Rather, we are constantly bridging the two. That we were slaves in Egypt is about empathy, yes, but it isn't just about empathy. It's also about our peoplehood as Jews. We are bound together as a Jewish people by the shared experience of bondage in Egypt. We remind ourselves of this lineage each year at Passover. Consider how much of the Passover Seder is a dialogue between parent and child, one generation teaching the other how to remember the story of our people. When we pour the second cup of wine, the Talmud instructs us. The child questions their parent, and if the child is not able to be understand the ask, then the parent teaches them how to ask. The story of being Gerim is a universal story, but it's also our story, our particular story. In a way, we can understand this cyclical storytelling, moving in and out of the Ger experience, as a rejection of the idea that we must choose between one of two camps, either to be tribal, purely and radically tribal, and only care about the Jewish experience, or to be universal, radically universal, and divest from the Jewish experience, to commit fully to the cause of the day and abandon our particularity. By remembering that we were slaves in Egypt, we have the opportunity to move between the eternal and the temporal, between our story and the story of others. We can remain invested in both our Jewishness and the universal elements of our Jewish experience, becoming more connected to Jews and to be better social justice advocates for all people. I'd like to take a moment to think about Mitzrayim, the Hebrew word for the land of Egypt. Etymologically, excuse me, the close cognate in Hebrew with the word is the noun Meitzar, a narrow or a pass. The word Mitzrayim is therefore sometimes understood to literally mean the narrows or the narrow place. The narrow place is one of hardship. In English, we might call these dire straits, right? Mitzrayim means the narrow place. I believe the narrowness of Mitzrayim correlates not only to situations we must flee, but also to the narrowness that we might locate in ourselves. Remembering that we were slaves in Egypt occasions us to ask, in what ways are we limited? Another way of asking this, in what ways are we limiting ourselves, keeping ourselves confined? Perhaps we are scared to raise our voices on an important issue. Perhaps we're not allowing ourselves the full expression of our identities. Perhaps we forbid ourselves from making art and exploring our creative side. Whatever it is, all of us contain parts of ourselves that yearn to be free. Let me share with you this Heschel quote I came across this morning. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said, "When we hear and accept what we hear without needing others, without asking how can it be, without looking for friends outside of our circles, when we accept hatred for a group as a legitimate discourse, Pharaoh is alive and well inside of ourselves." The narrow place is when Pharaoh is alive in us and giving us a narrow way to view other people. When we hear, "Remember, you were slaves in Egypt," it's important that we think about this oppression as emotional as well as historical. It's true that we were held in bondage by Pharaoh. It's true that this historical reality is in our DNA as Jews through intergenerational trauma. It's true that we must stay connected to this part of ourselves to be social justice advocates. However, it's also true that there's many different kinds of oppression in the world. Although we may be enjoying relative freedom in our daily lives, some of us may be holding parts of ourselves captive in our own internal mitzrayim. Right? There's no oppression Olympics, that there's only a binary of the oppressed and the oppressor. Each of us experiences oppression in different ways in our lives. When we remember our exodus from slavery, let that embolden us to break free from internal narrowness that keeps us from being the truest version of ourselves today. Our freedom is worth it. Your freedom is worth it. Each of us has unique gifts that are ours alone to pour from our soul into the world. But when we are confined internally, shaming ourselves with thoughts of not being good enough, not being smart enough, not being brave enough, we can't offer what is ours to give. In a sense, we cannot free others until we free ourselves. Only when we have liberated our souls from all the narrowness inside will we be fully able to help bring others with us. I want to be clear here that when I talk about freedom, I don't mean freedom from commitment and obligation. I'm not imagining a life of vacation outside of Mitzrayim as one completely devoid of responsibility, just being on a beach with a margarita, nothing against that, and where all we seek out is what we desire, right? There's so much in our lives worth feeling committed and obligated to. Our family, our communities, our neighbors, our shuls, our workplaces, our environment, the animals in our care. Freedom does not mean shirking off our responsibilities to one another to just go have a good time. Freedom does mean we can be our deepest and most authentic selves in the world without fear of rejection. When we trust that our deepest selves will not be rejected or scorned, we free ourselves from the narrowness of self-doubt and shame. Significantly, it's this kind of personal freedom that allows us to form deeper connections with others. Once again, we see how the individual and the collective are not at odds, but rather form a dialogue that allows a rich and full life to be possible. I'm not going to pretend that the path towards collective liberation is easy. The forces of negativity and bigotry are strong. All over the world, we see growing anti-immigrant, nationalist, white supremacist, xenophobic sentiments. In America, we guard our southern border with terrible violence and cruelty at times. None of us are likely to ever forget the images of children held in cages at migrant detention centers, kept separate from their parents, not allowed to shower or even see sunlight. There's politicians who have made their whole careers out of the promises to oppress the gerim, who flee their seeking only safety. They become Pharaoh. There are other forces that keep us locked in our own internal Mitzrayim. For example, we must contend with a capitalistic society that measures our worth at times, not through our being internally, but through the extent of our production. We are pushed to conform to the mentality that wealth is the measure of success and the highest possible value to attain. On top of that, we all have internal voices that tell us to be afraid, that we are not enough, that we are not strong enough, that we are not brave enough, that we are not powerful enough to commit to the path that our soul desires. These voices are another form of Pharaoh. Many of us believe these voices. We believe that we are not worth it. The negative forces we face, be they internal or external, will always be there. To leave Mitzrayim is not a one-time action followed by a life of liberation, free from all the forms of Pharaoh in our lives. Rather, like the story of Passover that we read every year, the exit from Mitzrayim into liberation is a cyclical one. Every year we remember that we were slaves in Egypt. Every year we enter the space of Mitzrayim. Every year we leave Egypt. So too is the act of freeing ourselves and our communities from oppression and ongoing struggle. So why is the idea that we were slaves in Egypt one of the 10 greatest Jewish ideas? After all, Mitzrayim is a place we want to leave, not a place we want to be. The answer that I hope I have established is that remembering we were slaves in Egypt can be deeply generative. It can ignite our compassion and drive for our social justice work. It can bind us together as Jews in a shared experience of peoplehood, not to mention a divine connection. And it can inspire us to break free of the external and internal forces that keep us from being the truest version of ourselves. Friends, to conclude here, a risk of any experience of oppression is that some people will remain stuck in their own trauma, lived or inherited, solely focused on them and their own peoplehood, their own narrative, their own race or ethnicity. We have all seen how experiences of oppression can lead not to great compassion, but to heightened shame, ethnocentricity, nationalism, and sometimes explicit racism. Meaning the experience of oppression may not be generative if we remain stuck in Mitzrayim, whether that place was for us. However, if we are able to move out of the narrow place, we may be able to evoke historical trauma for compassionate ends. We may be more compassionate to the vulnerable people in our community, to outsiders, and to our deepest selves. This is the power and potential of the idea that we were slaves in Egypt. It is our message for the world. We must find ways to honor our trauma. Indeed, we all have historical, intergenerational traumas on the collective and individual level. We must not dismiss these experiences one bit, but we must not be stuck in them. Rather, we must learn how to channel them so that all of us may find ways to keep leaving Egypt year after year. Okay, my dear friends, that was a lot of words, and I'm feeling them very deeply today, with Passover coming up and with various things happening in the world. Yes, hi, Gary Gartzman.
Hey, hello. I was struck by the quote, do not hate the Egyptian, from 23:8, because I've familiar with that we were oppressed in the land of Egypt. We were oppressed by Pharaoh, but I don't recall reading, were we oppressed by Egyptians, the Egyptian people? Is there writings or sense of, did the slave, I mean, how did they feel about the Egyptians, or did we, or do we know? I mean, I can understand your slave master and the people oppressing you, but there had to be some interaction with Egyptian people walking around. Do we know anything about how the Israelites, quote unquote, felt about the Egyptians as a people?
Great. Yes. Great. Great question. Before we dive into that, I'm going to share this quote by James Baldwin on the side, who wrote, I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain. And that is a really important James Baldwin thought, that oftentimes we allow hate to fester in our hearts because it would be much more painful to not live with that hate. I think that part of what the Torah is telling us to do there and not hating the Egyptians is to say, you know what, you're going to have to look at that pain and feel that pain and not hide from it with this other emotional experience. And I think that's exactly right. I think that oftentimes Holocaust survivors and their children who have had trouble buying German products often move from just a hate of Hitler and of Eichmann and all of the top dogs or hate from Nazis into hate of a German people. And that extends as well. So for that, you know, if Black people who hold a slave narrative who come to hate white people, or white people who are racist, or Jews who have left Egypt who now hate Egyptians. And you're exactly right. The narrative is not what Egyptians have done to you. You know, it really is the responsibilities up top. Of course, we know the power dynamics and the complicity involved, although It's a really powerful question. How much do we hold morally accountable those who are complicit in tyranny? How much do we hold accountable the common Nazi soldier for executing certain commands? And so too, how much do we hold accountable the Egyptian taskmaster, who's also kind of been brainwashed into that lifestyle, or the slave owner? And so I think your question is really powerful around the Egyptians. And I think that's part of what's happening there as well. Part of it, I think, is this James Baldwin idea around us doing this spiritual and emotional growth. Don't be stuck in Mitzrayim. And part of it is, like you're saying, like, you can't hold the Egyptians all accountable, right, for what Paro did. And as a reminder, that it's not Pharaoh who says, look how much the Israelites are growing. It's the Torah who says it. The Torah says, oh my gosh, the Israelites are growing so fast. So too, Americans, there's nothing wrong with being afraid of how many migrants are crossing the border, right? Whether someone is a Democrat or Republican, it seems to be a national fear of how many people are crossing. Right. The question is not, were you afraid of that? The question is, what did you do with fear? Did you use fear to oppress, or did you use fear to humanize? And so too, the Torah itself expresses a fear of how much Israelites are growing. Not a fear, but kind of a statement of reality. And it doesn't say the Egyptians are afraid, only that Pharaoh himself is kind of embracing that fear. So yeah, Gary, anyways, really powerful point there. So thank you for that. And that we should, and in fact, one last thought. We should remember that the people who have hurt us oftentimes, well, through the power of projection, for example, the people who have hurt us, we often extend that pain into other people. A mother hurt us, so we're upset with mothers. A man hurt us, so we're upset with men. Right? A person of a certain race or ethnicity hurt us, so we're afraid of those people. And so too, Pharaoh hurt us and Pharaoh's system, and so we become hateful of all Egyptians. And that's important to remember. Another good example in the contemporary moment, we should hate Hamas. Hamas is one of the most evil regimes on the planet. And we should never hate Palestinians, right? That the common Palestinian person we should humanize. Of course, there's a more complicated relationship when it's a type of Palestinian who sympathizes with terrorism, right? But that's an important thing, that this is not a war against Islam, God forbid, not a war against Palestinians, God forbid. It's a war against the terrorist group Hamas. And so too, it's a war against Pharaoh. Now that becomes difficult with the plagues and the Egyptians kind of, you know. But anyways, I've said a lot. So Mary, thank you. Aglaya, over to you, and then David Newman.
Okay, History Diva's back. Okay, so the short version of the story, though, is that if I've told this story before, I'm really sorry, though, but one of the hardest days that I ever had during my dissertation research was one day when I went in and I had this book that was, I think, published in the 1740s. I can't remember exactly when, but it was in my hands. And basically, though, they're describing the genocide against the Natchez people, the French perpetrated genocide against the Natchez people. Now, all their eyewitness accounts of this and everything. And one of the eyewitness accounts was also that they turned over enslaved people who were fighting on the side of the Natchez, because they wanted their freedom. They turned them over to an enemy tribe to be tortured and burned alive and everything. And they're saying, hey, this is for the good of the colony and everything. I mean, the commandant did this, so it must be okay. So all I wanted to do was throw the book across the room, though, but I didn't do that because, well, that book is older than I am, though. But I had to turn it in and I had to leave because I couldn't, I was just sort of like, I can't do this today. Now, later on that night, I don't want to get into too many details about why I had these weird ideas about heaven and hell, though, but I had weird ideas about heaven and hell that I had since childhood, and I don't really want to talk about that, though. But one of the things that was in my mind was, okay, so the person who wrote this and the commandant who actually, basically sanctioned this genocide, ordered this genocide and everything like that, should they be rotting in hell and everything? It took me a while before I had to actually admit to myself that I was extremely glad that there are some decisions that I don't get to make. And so one, because piggybacking on Gary Guardsman, people do, I mean, it is the government and everything though, but people do support this with or without thinking and everything though. However, though, at the same time though, where does it end? Okay, so if I'm sitting there, like I had to answer the question finally. I never wanted to answer the question about whether or not I hate oppressors who are long dead. Before then, I never wanted to answer the question really. I would say, yeah, but I don't want to hate them, but, okay, which is a coward's answer, I know. Okay, but that night I had to actually admit that I did have my answer to the question. No, because one, how am I different from that commandant if I actually let myself give in to that? And then two, another thing though is that, you know, so it goes on and on and on. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we were warned about that, was that if you hate the Egyptian, then it's never going to end. It's just going to keep going and going and going. And yeah, now, what's the point of telling this story and everything though? Just what's on my mind about, like right now, is, like I said, history diva showing up again. Okay, but on the one hand though, a lot of the time though, there's an assumption that if you are talking about things, you know, like oppression, slavery, all of that stuff, historically, then you are basically just trying to browbeat people who are descendants of these people. That's not necessarily true in my opinion though, but a lot of the time though, people do get very, very defensive about it. So, and then two, well then if this is where we're going, if this is what everyone's knee-jerk reaction, a lot of knee-jerk reactions are, then how do we talk about it? And then also, if we can't talk about it, where's it going to end? So I don't know, we're dealing with something that's very, very complex in this whole situation though. You know, I tried to answer it. I don't know how many times I tried to like deal with it, tackle it with people who are in the, you know, 18 to 22 range or the 16 to 22 range and everything like that though. And sometimes I have some success, sometimes not. A lot of the time, not. But anyway, though, it is what it is. So I don't know if anyone else here like wants to address that or anything like that, or if it's even interesting for anyone else to address though. But if we're going to remember, how do we deal with that?
Good. Thank you, Aglaia. Thank you. And your big questions, I'm going to punt to the group. Those who want to engage with those, I think they're really powerful questions. I'm going to briefly reflect on just two little side points you made along the way, while I'll leave the bigger ones for everyone else. The first is around this consistent issue throughout history of oppressing individuals in the name of the good of the collective. And I think we should be very aware of how that is still enters our political rhetoric today. And this continued tension morally and politically between collective welfare and individual rights. And to be sure, I don't think one party has a monopoly on how we should talk about that. I think there's a constant debate around state rights and federal, you know, and the federal role in the state and the individual and the collective. And I think just like the Nazis said, killing Jews was good for the human race, or like you said over there, it's good for the colony, you know, to burn people alive, right? I think that we should be aware of how these arguments of collective welfare are often used, you know, to hurt individuals. And that's one of the threats of a kind of utilitarian mindset. I'm not blaming utilitarianism. The notion that that human rights don't actually matter as much as the sum welfare of the system of people involved. So that's my first reflection on what you shared. And then the second is on hate. I want to remind us that in Jewish law is, this may sound cold to some, but it is not so interested in emotions. Emotions are turned into actions, right? When you read the ketubah at a wedding, it's not a romantic document that talks about how you should have a heart that is full of love and like you should have this Valentine's Day and anniversary with flowers and wine and sparks of romance. Nothing against that stuff, right? It says, boom, you could like make sure the person has clothes. Home, you should make sure the person has food. They should take care of people, right? Love is an action, not an emotion. So too, I would argue here when it says don't hate them, Egyptian, it's not saying don't have any emotions around hate. It's saying don't act on revenge. Don't take actions that would look like hateful actions. I think there's a much more complicated relationship to emotions. If anyone hasn't read the book by Simon Wiesenthal, The Sunflower, I might recommend it, because part of what The Sunflower is about is about a dying Nazi soldier who asks Simon Wiesenthal, as a Jewish camp inmate, to forgive him. He says, my dying wish is that you as a Jew forgive me as a Nazi. And Simon Wiesenthal struggled his whole life with that moment around whether it was his role and his place and whether he had the moral right to forgive this dying Nazi, give him the gift of dying with peace, or to say it's not my role to do that. And he grapples with the emotions involved with collective trauma and the roles of his own emotions with hate and healing. And it's a remarkable book. They have a later publication of the book that deals with many commentators over the decades in relationship to him in that book. He spent his life as a Nazi hunter, and he did feel there was a place for forgiveness and for healing, even though he felt there was ultimate accountability had to be sought. And that becomes very difficult. How do we balance justice with forgiveness? And how do we balance our own healing from hate and from pain alongside the ongoing justice needs? Very complicated issues, and I'm happy to keep engaging that. And thank you, Eddie, for posting that Heschel quote that Cindy had requested earlier that I had shared around how we Pharaoh's alive within us when we allow ourselves to live with bias and hate. Okay. Aglaya, thank you, and I hope folks will continue to engage with her great contributions, which went far beyond what I shared. David Newman, over to you, and then other folks can weigh in as well.
Good. Hey, group. Glad to be here. I was struck by the centrality of this idea that treating the ger lovingly with respect, you know, is so central, because I thought, well, you know, monotheism, maybe that's a big idea, and you know, peace, searching for peace. They're all big ideas. But this idea, when I think of my growing up in St. Louis with Rabbi Jerome Grolman in the 60s, and I was a little kid, and he was very powerful. You know, he marched with Martin Luther King. Just one quick memory, he was talking about Black power, and he invited these Black revolutionaries with, I think they had guns, at least that's in my mind. They came up and they talked about, you know, why they were doing what they were doing. And so this essential commitment to freedom just runs through Judaism, I think. And so I'll close with, this is the third class. So with Rabbi Shlomi, the first is everything and everyone matters. The second class was repair is possible. And now we're talking about the third class, liberation is possible, and it's essential for ourselves and for others. So I see a huge, beautiful theme running through this.
Thank you, David, for that. And I think we should feel proud of the historical role that these Jewish values played in helping to shape history and continue to. And I think one of the reasons we want to keep Judaism alive is not just because, oh, our grandparents would be disappointed if we abandoned this whole project, but because the world relies on these values. Again, this is not to say that other communities don't have important values. We should learn from them as well. And that some of these values might even be shared, but that these unique approaches have values. So to say two things to what you shared. First is, I am not in the camp of a war against Tikkun Olam. There are people who think that the phrase Tikkun Olam is a distortion of Judaism. I am not at war with Tikkun Olam, even though I think it's oftentimes, you know, maybe overused or misused. Tikkun Olam does have a place in the Talmud, in Mishnah Gittin. It does have a place in Kabbalah, as we talked about in the first two sessions around liberating sparks and the like. But Tikkun Olam is not in the Torah. But I think if we're going to root social justice, or however phrase we want to use for the notion of our responsibility for humanity in the world, more authentic would be this phrase that we were slaves. I think this emerges in the Torah and gets used for millennia as the idea of empathy and the idea of liberation work, this consciousness. Just one more thing on David's point around monotheism. As a reminder of Plato's point, monotheism is directly connected to human rights in that, according to Plato, that a polytheist has many gods and thus many moral truths and falls into a kind of form of relativism that does not stand for human rights, but honors different cultures in the most radical sense, doing things however they want. And it's cultural imperialism to advocate for human rights against another culture, right? Plato says, if you have one God, you have one moral truth. And you have the notion that all humans are created in the image of God, and that has to be defended on an absolute basis. And so I think actually this notion that this theology of a God liberating us from Egypt is directly connected to the idea that all humans are created in the image of God. And that's a value we should fight for in the world. In fact, I wrote an op-ed today on how we should stand up for the women and girls in Gambia against the female genital mutilation that's happening there, that the Islamic extremists who are advocating to reinstate female genital mutilation, because God forbid women have sexual pleasure, we should cut off their clitoris. Some people who are radical relativists say, how dare you, go against this radical Islamist who wants to impose this. That's their culture and they have the right, right? And I say, you're right. Like, this is not against Islam. It's not against them. And I'm not saying as outsiders we should fight them, but we should empower the women in those tribes on a grassroots level to have conversation and build their power to protect their girls, against this mutilation and cutting. And so that's a good example where I believe human rights outweighs a cultural relativism. Lots more to say about that. But okay, Dr. Janie Heydrich, over to you, and then Cindy Ketzoff.
Yeah, I saw this whole talk today as saying that the purpose of everything is not what's happened to us, a personalization, a personal revenge, a personal hurt, but it's about how we turn anything into making ourselves better and into making the world a better place. So to me, the conversation about forgiveness is, why am I putting myself in the center of something and saying, I've been hurt, I need to forgive? No, the problem is with the person who initiated the hurt. That person needs to grow from that hurt that he or she did to someone else, become a better person. And we need to move ourselves and the world beyond that hurt to how can we learn from it? How can we become better people? And how can we make a better world from it? And to me, that was the whole purpose of what you were talking about with Egypt. It's not, can I forgive the Pharaoh? Can I forgive the Egyptians? It's no, okay, this thing happened. This was horrible. But how am I going to use that experience to become a better person and to make a better world? And that, to me, is the essence of Judaism.
Thank you, Dr. Janie Heydrich. I think that's so powerful. And for us to think about how these experiences can make us stronger and add more beauty and holiness and justice to the world. And that's really worth thinking about. And it's such deep work because, as we know, the traumatized can become, oppressors also. And when we don't do that work of that conversion that you talked about, it's very easy for that to happen. And there's a book I'm reading now. When I say I'm reading a book, it's like a page a day given my lack of space to do it. So I'm literally through the prologue, but I do want to recommend it anyways, given how much I understand about what he's doing. Those who are thinking, it's called Healing Collective Trauma, a process for integrating our intergenerational and cultural wounds. And part of what Thomas Hubble over here is talking about, he's Austrian, and he deals with the traumas of the Holocaust, well, really of World War II, in the Austrian society and what happened in Austrian society. And also how so much of the oppression that we're looking at today is because of the unchecked shadows of intergenerational trauma on many different fronts. And for us to take that approach is very deep. There is a phrase in the Talmud, Yafash Feish B'masav, which says, theologically, our role is not to answer the problem of evil. Why does evil exist if there's a God and the God is good? Rather, our work is that when we see evil, how do we become better? When we experience suffering, how do we enable that suffering to make us more kind and more giving and more loving? And of course, it implies there that we shouldn't advise others in that. Our role with another person suffering is not to tell them to use their suffering for good. That's their own work. Our role is to comfort them. But for ourselves, we can live and model with taking our own pain and channeling it towards that good. So Janie, thank you for that beautiful reminder. Cindy Katzoff and then Nona.
Yes. Well, I'm a very practical person, and you know, what you've talked about, you know, is so basic. And I know many from people across the spectrum, they would deny being racist. Where did this get lost? You know, and how do we change the perspectives of all these Jews who are, you know, have such right-wing thoughts and channeling that into their politics and so forth?
Wow. Cindy, thank you for asking that. Yes, I want to start by acknowledging my own bigotries and biases. It is my belief that we all hold these. And I myself continue to hold biases, some that I know of and some that I don't know of, on as it relates to gender and sexual orientation and race and ethnicity. And I continue to become more and more aware of those. And there's nothing wrong with holding those. We all hold those, we can, I believe, and can never not hold some of them. The question is what we do with them as we become aware of them. And so we can use them to be in a way that spiritually expands us and can be generative, or we can use them to tear down. And so those awarenesses are really powerful and important. And in fact, one of the ways, for example, I continue to learn of my own misogyny is by being a father to daughters. having daughters has been such a powerful awakening of just realizing my own kind of awareness of how do I raise my boys differently than my girls? And why am I doing that? And when I hear my girls, you know, tell me experiences of what boys do to them at school, how much that awakens in me, you know? And as a when I was a foster parent to Black kids, and when I was a foster parent to Mexican kids and Native American kids, how much I internalized. I only half mean this, but there were times I felt I was Black. I felt I was Native American because I identified so deeply with this child as my child, and was so defensive of them that I felt I was their biological parent in moments. And I felt, anyways, it's a whole different issue. So anyways, I think the work of bigotry and bias is here for all of us to do. And but your question is still relevant. Some of us have some light work to do there, and some people have some very heavy work to do there. And those
but they don't know they need to do the work.
They don't know. Right. There are Jews, and I think it's okay for us to call them out. Mm-hmm. There are Jews who believe all Muslims are evil. There mm-hmm. are Jews who believe, you know, that Black people are inferior. Mm-hmm. There are Jews who take beliefs like that and put them into political frameworks. And if they don't argue that, they may put policies in place that imply that. If I live in a district where I, as a Jew, have the majority of the power, but I want to strip all public schools of their funding because all my kids go to private school, right? And I'm in an Orthodox Jewish society of Lakewood, New Jersey, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't care about the minorities in Lakewood, New Jersey, because all I care about the yeshivas being funded. I'm mm-hmm. saying a Black child's education doesn't matter as much as my Jewish child's right. education. Right. If I live in the West Bank and I support policies of expansionism, even if it displaces people who have lived in a certain land for centuries, I am saying that their life does not matter as much as my own. And there are policies that continue to show that. Now, we have to be careful with that, because there are many valid political beliefs that are easily to accuse of being racist that are not necessarily, even though I might take a liberal approach on mass incarceration, I don't know that everyone who believes we should, you know, take a more conservative approach to law and order is racist. I don't know that everyone who thinks that we should have a more conservative approach to taxation is racist because more people of color live in poverty. I don't know that every person who believes we should have tougher border laws is xenophobic, right? So it's very easy to say, if you don't vote liberal, you are a racist and a xenophobic, blah, 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 blah. And I want to move us away from that thinking, because I think it's actually destructive of American society for mm-hmm. Democrats to say all Republicans are racist, xenophobes, blah, 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 blah. I think it's not generative. And I think it's all, you know, so too that every Jew who, you know, lives in the West Bank, or every Jew who, you know, votes conservative is themselves this and that. But I do think that we should be prepared to call out community members who use xenophobic and racist rhetoric and embrace policies of extremism. And so Cindy, I thank you for that. And I do think that that we should call them in rather than call them out. I mean, there's a place for calling them out when they get to extremes, but I do think that Jews are best placed to call in our Jewish family members and have hard conversations and help them get proximate, right? Help them talk to people different than themselves that they've never talked to. I am so sorry that we're at time here, because I think we've only scratched the surface on this issue, and I know there's a number of other people who want to continue to jump in. Yes, thank you, Judy Shaffer. We can't stereotype conservatives as bigots just because they would prescribe different solutions for Sile's shortcomings. And I think that actually when liberals do that, I actually think that we're increasing a divide in a way that destroys our society more and more. Just as, you know, when people like Ben Shapiro and the like, you know, want to tear down liberals as evil people. And like, you know, it's so destructive. And so I think that there's certain ideologies we should hate, but we should really call people in. Thank you all for joining us. I can't wait to see y'all next week. And thank you for all your contributions. Have a beautiful day.